Since the serendipitous discovery of the effects of botulinum toxin on the skin by Jean and Alistair Carruthers in 1992, the multitude of advances and uses of Botox have been almost exponential.
I'm having a discussion today with Dr. Aaron Gilbert, who is Assistant Professor of Dermatology at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in New York, and also has a PhD in neurosciences. So she has a special interest in botulinum toxin, different, I think, from most of the rest of us dermatologists. Aaron, we're going to discuss today something that people don't think that they're going to be hearing. And I'm sure that everyone is thinking, oh my God, here we go, not another talk on botulinum toxin and wrinkles. We're going to talk about non-cosmetic uses of botulinum toxin in dermatology and other processes, other disease states that we may have some peripheral interest in at least as well, to try to give people an idea of how it's being used. And these are all off-label uses, obviously, since the medication is approved for certain neurologic diseases, I guess, and wrinkles in a certain area on the face only. So tell me a little bit about why you have an interest in botulinum toxin uses apart from wrinkles.
Well, botulinum neurotoxin uses in areas apart from wrinkles is something that has been not very well explored. It's something that we have seen a few case reports in the past, and we really have not heard a lot about for the past 10 years or so. It's something that is gaining more interest, but I think it's an area that we need to start looking into a lot more. So when we think about how we use botulinum neurotoxin in dermatology specifically, as you mentioned, Gary, we talk a lot about the idea of using it for cosmetics, but we really have not started to really understand well how we can apply this within medical dermatology. That would be the basic answer, and I can get into more detail.
We all have to remember that the whole scenario and the whole change in dermatologic surgery occurred because it was being used for its appropriate medical use by Jean Carruthers, and the story that I have heard repeated at least by Dr. Lawrence Field many times. And if the Carruthers are listening to this, they can call me up and yell at me. But the story that I had heard was that they were visiting Dr. Field and staying at his home. And then this was a bedtime discussion where she was telling Alistair when they went to sleep, Alistair, I noticed that when I was injecting patients for blepharospasm, that their wrinkles seemed to be going away. And Alistair, Jean being the ophthalmologist, Alistair being the dermatologist, and dermatologic surgeon said, oh, and they started injecting people in their office, and maybe themselves even, and found out that wrinkles would, in fact, be controllable by botulinum toxin. And that's how everything in dermatology changed 180 degrees in terms of the emphasis of things that were occurring in dermatology. I remember, too, and I'm not taking credit for this, it's a sort of silly statement, but I took Alistair's course multiple times before I had the courage to use botulinum toxin for wrinkles because I was concerned about its neurologic effects, and mentioned to him, you know, if this worked with cholinergic nerves, I bet it would work with sweating. And Alistair said, oh, yeah, that's an interesting concept. And then he tried to do it for hyperhidrosis and couldn't get it to work. And then subsequent to that, within the next 6 months or so, the literature came out from Europe where people were starting to use it for hyperhidrosis. So again, a non-wrinkle implication and something that I think is still not approved. I don't think in the United States, is it approved for hyperhidrosis?
Yes, I mean, we're getting to that point. But I think that you raise very good points. I mean, and hello, Jean and Alistair, if you're listening, you're absolutely right. And I think that what we have to start thinking about it a little bit more, looking historically, I mean, your historical info is really helpful, but what we also need to remember, as you say, is when we think about the uses of botulinum toxins, the dermatologic, as you mentioned, the uses are a fraction of what the actual uses are within the entire medical community. So we are but a tiny pea in the pod, as you say, of the rest of the uses of botulinum neurotoxins. So whether we're looking at botulinum toxin type A, type B, type C, different types of neurotoxins, you're absolutely right in saying that we're really at the very beginning of looking at how we can even expand this further. So the origins within ophthalmology, I think, are very interesting, and I think that's correct. And we can see this continuing in terms of its use in urology, in overactive bladder, also used even in cardiology, uses in a whole bunch of different GI now. They're using a lot of toxin for GI. So I think it's almost come 360. in a way, in terms of the dermatologic history, back to skin disease at this point. So Jean and Alistair, I think we're looking from the ophthalmology work, and then I think we've come a little bit to this point now in terms of my interest in looking at it, also bringing it back to medical dermatology.
So apart from hyperhidrosis, which is a medical scenario, not a cosmetic scenario, what other kinds of things are dermatologists using it for that may be dermatologic? I'm sure some people, such as me, I will oftentimes, if a patient comes in complaining of migraine, asking me, I have migraine as well as wrinkles, can this treat my migraine too? And then I'll inject them, but I don't do the traditional migraine injections in the back of the head as well. I just do them on the forehead or at trigger points for the migraine. But what kinds of things are dermatologists doing off-label for things other than wrinkles and hyperhidrosis?
Well, I think there's a fraction of patients who really come in complaining of pain disorders, of itch disorders, and also of vascular phenomena. So I think that when you're thinking about how we can actually apply this, there are people, and it's a subset of the dermatologic community. It's not a huge part of who we are in terms of the masses. It really tends to be people who are a little bit more on the cutting edge and are willing to try things that are new. People are using it for post-herpetic neuralgia. They're using it for atopic dermatitis. In some cases, there have been case reports. This is sort of what we're finding in the literature. And also the thing that I'm interested in, which we've seen before, is psoriasis. And I've actually worked with a collaborator quite closely who has a basic science lab. She and I are both neuroscientists. Her name is Dr. Nicole Ward. She's at Case Western. And what we've done is actually developed a mouse model of psoriasis. It's actually her mouse model. It's a transgenic mouse. And what we've shown is that by using botulinum neurotoxin type A, what we can do is actually provide the same effect as chemical as a denervation. So in other words, using botulinum neurotoxin type A, by injecting a single injection, you can effectively get the same effect on plaque psoriasis as you can with denervation, actually cutting the nerves within the skin. And this was published in the JID in September of last year. And this is something that we're exploring further, just with sort of case reports at this point in humans, and we've had actually very good results so far.
Well, for the dermatologists out there listening who don't have mice with psoriasis and cut the nerves, what does denervation do to psoriatic plaque? I mean, are there increased cholinergic nerves around underneath psoriatic plaques?
So there are increased nerve numbers within psoriatic plaques. You also have increased vessels because of our famous Auschwitz sign, right? So we know that there's increased vessels, there are increased nerves. We also know that the immune system is activated differently within psoriasis. So we know that the circulating dendritic cells and the circulating T cells are also higher in number in a psoriasis plaque. So the question is, what is this process? Is it something that is strictly autoimmune? Is it something that is inflammatory? Is it neuroinflammatory? How do we think about this condition from an overall perspective as dermatologists? And we know, because we use topical steroids all the time, that the immunologic component can be calmed down. We also know, because we use biologics, that the immunologic can be calmed down using mechanisms, whether it's TNF-alpha or others, or IL-17, which is sort of some of our newer medications that are coming out as targets. We know we can use these medications to actively calm psoriasis. And I'm not proposing with this type of work that we would be able to treat somebody who's got a high PASI score, who's got psoriasis all over their body. What we're really doing with this work is kind of looking at people who have refractory plaque. So this is people, in the case of psoriasis, where you might want to consider somebody who's on a TNF-alpha inhibitor, they're on some sort of biologic, and they have got refractory plaque. This is something that seems to be working for them.
Are you producing vasoconstriction here? Is that what you think your mechanism is, so there's less blood flow to the area?
No, the mechanism of action, as far as we know, and it's something that's still being explored, but in the mouse studies, what we found is that basically we're reducing the number of circulating CD4 positive T cells and CD11C positive dendritic cells. So what that means is the inflammatory infiltrate is different. We also know that acanthosis is different. And so what we found is that this is a very, very different result than we've gotten before using topical steroids. So effectively what you see see is that what you're doing is, rather than cutting the nerves, you're using a chemodenervation. So it's not really so much about vasoconstriction, which is part of what you're going to see a bit with a steroid, obviously temporarily. It's a little bit more about trying to understand how the neuroinflammatory response is regulated. And it's something that everyone is interested in knowing the answer to. I mean, every company that has a botulinum neurotoxin wants to know the answer.
The botulinum toxin, you're saying, is then having a direct effect on inflammatory T cells?
Yes. It's hard to exactly measure. When you say a direct effect, that's hard to exactly measure in a laboratory sense. All we know is that when we inject botulinum neurotoxin into a mouse model of psoriasis at this point, because that's what we're dealing with a mouse model, because to get a human trial going, which is in the works, it's something that you have to get funded, and that's sort of what we're working on right now. But all what we see is we see that there is a reduced number of infiltrating T cells. There's a reduced number of infiltrating dendritic cells. And this is very hardy data. This is something that has been shown and published in JID multiple times. So it's good. I mean, it basically is, it's a real phenomenon, which is very exciting.
Well, the exciting part is the phenomenon is occurring. I'm just having difficulty understanding how something that in a human ordinarily hangs around for 30 minutes or a little bit more than that, and then is gone wherever it goes or goes into the bloodstream, can have a persistent effect on the T cells in one particular local area. You don't have any hypotheses as to how this is occurring.
Well, so
in that local area, it's not
affecting
the whole mouse. It's affecting that area you injected.
Well, that's right. So it is affecting the area that we injected. And the other piece of it is it's not entirely clear whether or not it's gone after 30 minutes. There's basically more data that's coming out now, which I think people are interested in looking at, is about questions like retrograde transport. Where does it actually live within the neuron? Effects that might be occurring at the dorsal root ganglion. So there are other questions in terms of where the toxin is actually living or the byproducts of the toxin activation. So in other words, we know that it's cleaving SNAP-25 and exerting some of its cholinergic effects in some areas. But the other question is, what are the effects on other nerve types, sensory nerves, other types of innervation that occur within psoriatic plaque and other derm conditions? So we're not really sure.
Yeah, there is evidence, or historical evidence, and certainly anecdotal from patients, that where we thought that this was just going to basically be affecting motor function. There are many patients who would come in as whose headaches disappeared, that we attributed to, well, their muscles were in spasm all the time from their frowning all the time. And so you just relax that, so their headaches went, the tension headaches went away, when in fact it may have had a direct effect on some sort of sensory effect. And patients, certainly as a side effect, some patients would complain of headache after the injections as though it was having a sensory effect as well. So I guess we're learning more that this is not just one, just a motor effect that this toxin has on nerves.
That's right. And I think that most of what we've found is a lot of, just to sort of have a little fun with it, one of the neuroinflammatory model in migraine, for example, there's a lot of discussion there about substance P and the role of substance P, which we know a lot about in inflammatory skin disease. So for example, people with atopic dermatitis can't really well differentiate between itch and pain. And we know that we've used things like capsaicin in the past to sort of target that, to benefit a bit from the fact that we can deplete their substance P. So that actually is something, and I don't know if you use capsaicin in your practice. I've tried it on my atopics. They are not very happy with me when I do it.
Not for atopics. And I generally don't even use it for zoster. Because it's so difficult to use, because you have to use it so often.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely right. But at any rate, there is an overlap between pain and itch, and people have difficulties sometimes distinguishing between the two. And I think that the thing that you are pointing to, which I think is very interesting, is the idea that substance P somehow may be involved in this process, this neuroinflammatory. In migraine, that certainly is the case. There's a lot of literature about that, as you mentioned. And so I think that the idea that there are these neuropeptides, what I would back up and say here is there are neuropeptides that, like calcitonin gene-related peptide, vasoactive intestinal peptide, substance P, a few others, even serotonin, for example, has been implicated in the vasodilatory response in rosacea. So there's a bunch of neuropeptides that we need to kind of start thinking about a little bit more closely and exploring what their role is within inflammatory skin disease. When we think about acetylcholine and botulinum neurotoxins, that limits us. That's really just one.
If we restrict it to just that, yeah.
Absolutely, right. Absolutely. So that's something that we're really just thinking about it inside a box, and I think we need to get outside the box a little bit.
Okay, well, in getting outside the box, are there other diseases other than psoriasis? Has it been tried in rosacea?
Yes, it has. It has been tried in rosacea, and there's been a bit of work that's gone on for a while. There was an article, I'm sure that you've seen Steve Diane's research. If you have not, Steve and Diane has a great paper in the JDD, and he was really looking at the flushing response in rosacea, so looking really more at like a flushing reaction or erythematous telangiectatic rosacea, and injecting small units of, he used Botox in this study, so he was actually able to, with fairly small doses, get a very long-standing result in patients. So much like Jean and Alistair were talking about periocular wrinkles, Steve was doing some work on patients looking for glabellar rhytids, and he found that there was less redness. And I think also people have treated patients for glabellar movement, and they found actually, speaking of hyperhidrosis, they've had these little rings where they kind of get less redness during their exercise regimens. So we know that there's some sort of neurovascular effect, and we're not really sure exactly what it is. And it's these same neuropeptides that remain sort of the key players that everyone's thinking about. And we don't truly know the answer, which is why I'm interested in continuing to do this research, because without human models, you really need skin. You really need human skin to be able to explore what this is. You can look at mouse models, which is really your preclinical work, but you really need to figure out more about what's going on in human disease states.
Are there any other tentative types of associations that we as dermatologists might notice or see or should start looking for, other than these little white rings during exercise, that tell us that something else is going on with the use of botulinum toxin?
Well, so the common things that you see are changes in the sebaceous activity within the skin. So we know, for example, that acne improves with the use of botulinum toxin. We know that pore size is reduced with the use of botulinum toxin. And again, I think people have a theory that there's some effect directly on the sebaceous gland or maybe on the erector pili muscle within the skin, but I don't think they're entirely sure how this is occurring. So there are theoretical studies, they're more observational studies, and I think that we need to, again, understand more of the basic science before we understand further about what's going on. So those are a few examples that I can give you, and I think there are a few more. People have used botulinum neurotoxin also in herpes zoster, post-herpetic neuralgia, and that really stems more from the pain literature. I think people have tried that a bit. And the other thing that they've tried it for is we know that it works for Raynaud's syndrome, for example, so why not for other neurovascular phenomena? So one thought that you could think about is something like port wine stain. That might be an interesting model to study it in. It's not going to be the same thing as lasering it.
Yeah, but they also have defective innervation,
right,
of the area.
Yeah, so that's an interesting...
You don't know what you're knocking off. You get less of whatever you're knocking off, you're knocking off.
Yeah, I think these are important questions. For the general dermatologist, I think that it's very, very useful for us to just be aware of where things might be going and understand a little bit more about how one could think about botulinum toxin use. I do use it actually for rosacea. I use it for pore size in my practice. It sounds sort of finicky, but people love it. You actually get a really nice result when you use it cosmetically in that way. And I also do use it for psoriasis in some of my patients. And they're happy to have it done. I mean, people have asked me a lot of times, you really want to come in and get an injection for psoriasis? I mean, people are thrilled. I mean, imagine if they're doing Enbrel. Of course, they probably have a higher PASI score. But if they've got a refractory plaque that's not going anywhere and it's on their scalp or it's somewhere visible, they are thrilled to have it improved.
Do you want to share with our listeners what kind of dosing you're using in these areas for this off-label use?
Well, at this point, there's going to be a case report coming out soon. So what I can say is it's basically would be equivalent to cosmetic uses. For rosacea, the dosing, which I can share with you, is basically somewhere between 0.5 and 1 unit per injection point. And that's literature that's been published.
Erin, what kind of time frame do you think is going to occur when people start reading about these things as they're coming up anecdotally in the literature? Do you foresee large numbers of dermatologists treating rosacea with botulinum toxin?
I think it really is a cost-benefit scenario, and I think you really have to decide who your population is. I think you're probably going to be looking at, people have been very interested in this topic, because I think that we use a lot of topicals, and when as soon as we start offering them something that is what I call kind of a more onboard therapy, it's almost like injecting a steroid. You can give them something that might last them for several months, and they don't have to apply a topical every day. If it works for them, this could be something that's really a benefit to them. So I think that people have been very intrigued. My word of caution about it, though, would be I think we really need to understand through the human trials how this is working. And I'm not really so much concerned about things like, you know, muscular paralysis. It's more just let's get a better grip on what these molecules are doing and how they really can be applied safely with an FDA approval, either for this indication or others, so that we can really improve the quality of life of our patients. The goal here is safety, efficacy, cost effectiveness. So it doesn't make sense to bring someone in for me and charge them a huge amount of money to treat rosacea, and either A, it doesn't work, which will happen in a proportion of your patients. It always does. Whether you're a mouse or a human, there's sometimes when it just doesn't work. And so the other issue is cost. You know, is your practice the kind of practice where you can bring somebody in and you can say, hey, I've got a great treatment for you, but it's going to cost you $700 cash? You know, that's another consideration, or $500 cash. You got to find out whether or not that's what you're going to be able to do. And for the most part, what I've found is for people who don't have tremendous means, people who do have some means, they've really been willing to go this route because for them, it actually provides them with a lot of relief. So I think those are questions that we should think about.
Well, the interesting and exciting thing about this, too, would be to see if there's a dissociative effect with the botulinum toxin, as there is the dissociative effect between using botulinum toxin on the forehead for a patient for wrinkles, who also has a benefit on any hyperhidrosis in the forehead, and the wrinkles stay away for 4 months, but the hyperhidrosis stays away for 6 months. So if you're able to have a similar wonderful dissociative effect where you only have to inject someone's face for rosacea twice a year, then the cost is not going to seem prohibitive to somebody who looks like a tomato and then looks pretty normal when they're not tomato-faced.
That's a very, very good point. I think that's excellent. I mean, that's a very, very good point.
That'll be interesting to see whether it lasts 2 months or 6 months is going to probably make a big difference, too. And that might make a big difference for people in terms of when you consider the cost, for instance, in rosacea, the topical medications that they're using that each cost $200
exactly.
It's maybe much more cost-effective if this lasts 6 months as well.
That's exactly what I've been thinking. And I think also for people, as you mentioned, that have things like, you know, even seborrheic dermatitis, for example, changes a little bit when there's neurologic alterations. You know, you see people post-stroke, for example, on one side, their sebderm changes drastically. So if you look at the glabella or something you're treating anyway with a botulinum neurotoxin, I think your point is well taken, that this is something where they could get benefit.
Well, I want to thank you and, again, advise our listeners, this is all off-label use. Be cautious if you're going to be trying this, but again, it's very exciting, and we'll see in the next 2 years what new applications botulinum toxin is used for. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
The first FDA-approved use for botulinum toxin A was for blepharospasm, hemifacial spasm, and strabismus in 1989. Now the uses of Botox vary across specialties, from cervical dystonia, improvement of dynamic facial lines, migraine headaches, severe hyperhidrosis, and urinary incontinence due to spinal cord injury. Neurotoxin type A preparations are by far most frequently used for aesthetic purposes. There are three different formulations commonly used in the United States of neurotoxin A: onabotulinum toxin A, abobotulinum toxin A, and incobotulinum toxin A. The real question is, what are the differences in efficacy and safety of these three toxins? Why use one over the other? There have been several clinical studies comparing the efficacy of Inco versus Ana with a 1-to-1 conversion on indications for glabellar lines, crow's feet, and blepharospasm. All studies reported similar outcomes when comparing time of onset, time of waning, total duration of effect, and side effect profile. A study by Kasser et al. Published in 2013 comparing abobotulinum toxin A and onabotulinum toxin A in the treatment of facial rhytids showed that there was a difference in the onset of action. Patients had a quicker onset with abo than with ana. When comparing the response rates for abo and ana, they were equivalent between both treatments, with the endpoint being 3 months. A recent study published in the International Journal of Dermatology compared a novel type of botulinum toxin A, DWP450, to onabotulinum toxin A in the treatment of glabellar lines. This randomized controlled trial yielded that DWP450 was not inferior to onabotulinum and was comparable in efficacy and safety in the treatment of glabellar lines. So even with the safety and efficacy for each of these formulations being similar, the real difference is that each formulation is made with different neurotoxin-associated complexing proteins. These complexing proteins have different molecular weights and vary on the composition due to the growth and method of purifications. Because of these subtle differences, the immunogenicity of the various formulations is slightly different. In preliminary studies comparing neutralizing antibodies, it's been shown that INCO does not lead to antibody production, unlike ONA and ABO, which have been shown to elicit these neutralizing antibodies. Even with the frequent use of Botox, there are still adverse reactions experienced by some patients. Patients should be made aware of these before they get injections. In a multicenter prospective cohort study done in 2011, patients were encouraged to self-report any adverse reactions in cosmetic procedures. The most common reactions for Botox injections were hematoma and ptosis. Two patients out of 6,200 neurotoxin procedures reported adverse events. Overall, Botox injections are effective and safe for patients. The indications for injections in FDA-approved sites are growing each year. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we'll have an edition devoted entirely to office management. Remember to download the Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone. We also have a presence on Facebook and would like you to join the community online for fun, previews, and educational info. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Stay passionate about dermatology. Your expertise and continued hard work on behalf of your patients is recognized and appreciated and makes your colleagues and your community proud. Have another great month.